Hello, welcome to Razor's Edge, local and independent current affairs, straight from Sydney, on 2SER 107.3. I'm Daniel Butler. Today on the show...
I could not believe the number of women that we were turning away. You know, for every bed that we had available, we'd get three equally desperate requests for it, at least.
Women are the fastest growing group facing homelessness in the country. Frontline services are feeling the strain and say a change in attitudes towards survivors of domestic abuse is instrumental in tackling the crisis. Also on the show today...
And what ways studies finding is that they have, of course, a very different education system.
Clashes between Chinese and Hong Kong exchange students here in Sydney have once again raised the question of foreign students studying here in Australia. Will we see more clashes? And are there implications for one of our biggest export industries, education? But first, New South Wales Labor has had a shocker week, with senior members facing an uncomfortable grilling in front of the Independent Commission Against Corruption. Overnight, General Secretary of New South Wales Labor, Kayla Murnane, was stood down after explosive testimony revealing she had known since 2016 the party was taking unlawful donations. Lurid tales of large sums of money being handed over in shopping bags and devious schemes to disguise substantial donations from Chinese businessmen have all been divulged. There's been a particular focus on a Chinese Friends of Labor fundraising dinner in 2015, where false donor identities were used to obscure the real source of funds. Rob Osborne has this story.
Undue Chinese influence on Australian society has become a major concern in recent weeks, with the New South Wales Education Department deciding to withdraw from the collaborative arrangements with the Confucius Institute. Now, New South Wales Labor is implicated in a major scandal over funding from Chinese sources and is being investigated by the Independent Commission Against Corruption. I spoke to Dr. Stuart Jackson, lecturer in Australian politics at UTS, and asked him first what powers ICAC possesses.
Well, they're quite broad, keeping in mind that there's already been some investigation via the New South Wales Electoral Commission, which is what began all of this. But ICAC, being then informed, has an investigative and a compulsory power, power of compulsion upon people to provide evidence. So it's much stronger than, say, just the Electoral Commission, which can't compel people per se. So it has this investigatory power. Usually the investigations take a period of time, maybe 18 months, 2 years, before they come to fruition. And of course they're done in complete secrecy. When we hear about it is usually when the prosecutions are actually starting, and that's when something actually happens.
Reportable political donations in New South Wales are sums in excess of $1,000. For example, documents published on New South Wales Labor Party website show a donation of $4,400 from the Electrical Trades Union on the 28th of May 2019. I asked Professor Jackson about the rules governing donations.
The important part about the amounts is that they are separate. New South Wales Electoral Commission has a separate set of rules from the Australian Electoral Commission. So you are reporting at once to two authorities, particularly for a party like Labor, Liberal, National, Greens or One Nation, where they have registrations in both the federal and the state sphere. And this also allows for transfers of money or donations that might be made to the federal party then being channeled back through to the state party as a state transfer.
Arguably, New South Wales Labor Party lost office because of its history of various forms of corruption. Would you see these investigations as a continuation of that unfortunate tradition?
Very much so. Simple fact is that both major parties need the donations from developers or whoever, from business, to maintain themselves. The cost of elections is so high, and even with caps on spending as you have in New South Wales, you still have to generate a large amount of money to be able to run a campaign effectively. And then, of course, you have federal elections where you have uncapped elections, and so you actually really need to generate great deals of funds so that you can spend enough to potentially outspend the other side, as it were. So, cost of elections is rising nationally. Even if New South Wales is capped, there's still a need for large amounts of money up front, particularly as the New South Wales election has now disaggregated federal from state to local in terms of what money can be used for what kind of election.
How damaging could this investigation be for both state and federal Labor parties?
It's potentially more damaging for state Labor because it's once again been caught out trying to get around the election laws. That said, I think in some parts people accept that, you know, political parties are trying to get around particular kinds of laws dealing with them. They haven't gone out and killed someone. They haven't gone out and deliberately changed laws that get workers killed or whatever, or taken money away from people through workers' compensation changes. So in that sense, it's somewhat remote. It's not directly affecting most people. But yes, it certainly gives the impression about, well, this is what they do all the time, isn't it? This is the Labor Party writ large.
What penalties or punishments are ICAC able to impose? Can they initiate criminal proceedings, for example?
They would normally pass any findings that they have through to the Director of Public Prosecutions, usually with a tag saying that this appears to have occurred under this particular legislation. So they wouldn't initiate criminal proceedings. That would actually come through from the state DPP. The DPP is independent from government, so it tends to prosecute cases that they believe, A, there's a prima facie case, B, there's actually the evidence to prove it, thus there's a likelihood of conviction, and three, that they, you know, see that this is in the public interest in many respects, and they would definitely pursue it.
This current investigation seems to focus on the role of Chinese businessmen. Do you detect a growing atmosphere of Sinophobia in Australian politics?
Yes, there is a rising sense of it. Is it misplaced? Yes, I think it largely is. Australia's had a very, very long relationship with Asia in general. This I mean before Captain Cook arrived, before Captain Phillip set up camp initially in Botany Bay on Canal, but before he got around to Port Jackson and Sydney Cove, we had trade between Aboriginal people and people from the Moluccas, people potentially from China. So certainly there's been trade through that area for many years. Some of the earliest settlers in Australia were Chinese.
Dr. Stuart Jackson, lecturer in Australian politics at the University of Sydney, speaking there with Rob Osborne.
In the House, cult film Classics returns to Event Cinemas George Street on September 2nd, screening comedy classic The Castle, the number one Australian comedy that sticks it up the big guys.
It's just the vibe of the thing.
Do not miss your favourite cult classics back on the big screen now on Monday nights. Hosted by the Movie Nerds. Check the full film list and grab tickets at eventcinemas.com.au. Event Cinemas George Street sponsors 2SER.
I'm Daniel Butler and you are listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. Well, did you know that women are almost four times more likely than men to be hospitalised after being assaulted by their partner? With Sydney's rapid population growth, social services must keep up with rising rates of domestic violence. Professor Sarah Wendt studies social work at Flinders University and works on the front line of domestic violence prevention. She's passionate about lowering the rates and supporting victims from a range of angles. Julia Andre reports on this issue.
Why doesn't she just leave? It's a question that often bears down on women who are victims of family and domestic violence, of which they are three times more likely to experience than men. CEO of Women's Community Shelters, Annabelle Daniels, provides 30,000 sleeping nights a year to family violence victims in 6 shelters across Sydney.
I would say, why aren't we asking the question, why does he continue to abuse her, often when he's already promised to stop? I think, again, when we say, why does she leave, we're blaming the victim. We need to look at why perpetrators abused in the first place. For me, you know, the corollary to the question, well, why doesn't she leave, is the answer, well, where would she go?
In Australia, one woman is murdered at the hands of her intimate partner each week, and this statistic is holding steady. Whilst this number is shocking, it doesn't account for the women being hospitalised, going to emergency departments, or just surviving physical and sexual violence at home. With such a stark lack of government funding, safe havens for women are struggling to keep up.
I could not believe the number of women that we were turning away. You know, for every bed that we had available, we'd get 3 equally desperate requests for it, at least. A couple of years ago, when we were setting up the Sanctuary Hills Women's Shelter in the Hills District, you know, we'd had a bit of media around setting up the shelter, and we had approximately 15 women attempt to put themselves on a waiting list for when the shelter was actually open, you know, which is 2.5 times the actual capacity of the shelter.
Professor Sarah Wendt is a professor of social work at Flinders University and has worked on the front line of domestic violence prevention. According to Professor Wendt, action needs to be taken across society to prevent family violence.
I would argue that domestic violence is an expression of gender inequality, and domestic violence in and of itself reinforces gender inequality. And so when we look at men's behaviour change or men's attitudinal change, often counsellors or social workers or psychologists who work from that premise of gender inequality would be not only wanting to stop the violence, so looking at tools about how men understand their use of violence and therefore how you stop it, but they would also be wanting to look at the broader social cultural messages that reinforce that violence is okay.
Domestic violence may be a national epidemic, but it's also being reflected worldwide. A recent study by the United Nations found that women across the globe are most likely to be killed by their partners. Professor Wendt has seen success in men's behavioural change programs.
Most programs here in Australia often have about 12 weeks where men come together, where a group is facilitated by either, you know, social workers or psychologists facilitating that group to encourage men to talk about their lives, talk about their use of violence, where those ideas come from, talk about tools or other activities that can help enable behaviour change, but more importantly, how you engage in conversations with men about changing attitudes towards their use of violence or attitudes more broadly towards women and children who are the predominant victims of domestic and family violence.
To set up their newest shelter in Parramatta, Annabelle said strong community action was a necessity and reflected on the impact individuals can make in taking a stand against domestic violence.
Volunteers are the icing on the cake. There's a really wide range of activities that volunteers can get involved in the local level, and we see this as part of community education and awareness raising around domestic and family violence, because it's always been an issue that's kind of been closed off from communities before. And we actually think that that bringing people in to help solve the problem is both educative and supportive for the shelters.
Professor Wendt agreed actions need to be taken at a community level as well as being supported by the government.
It's really important that when you do understand domestic and family violence from a gender inequality perspective, this points to how community members might be able to respond safely and ethically when they come across it. And so, for example, we know in the research that if a woman or a child decides to reach out to someone just to check in and say, look, this is kind of what's happening. I'm not sure what's happening. I'm a bit scared. If they don't get a good response where they're believed or respected in telling that, that can often shut down women and children from ever seeking help again. And so I think the first step in responding to domestic and family violence as a community is that if women and children are brave enough to talk about this, then the first position should be one of listening, one of believing, and then one of asking, are you okay, and exploring the safety for that woman and that child.
The financial effects of family violence on victims is an often forgotten but devastating detail. In a survey of 700 women, Professor Wendt found that a large portion of these women had to stop work, change their place of employment, or drop from full-time to part-time roles.
So we know that domestic and family violence will often always have crisis modes. And so if we have supportive workplaces that allow women, say, a bit of time off or, you know, just some space to get through that crisis, but they maintain their employment, then that's a really, really good response. So it's about being supportive, understanding that crisis can happen, and that having a bit of time off to collect one's social, emotional, financial and safety needs in that crisis and then being able to come back to work is an excellent response.
As Sydney's population continues to soar, domestic violence prevention and support facilities must keep up. In Camden, an area with a population that is set to grow by 300% by 2030, community support has been integral in the establishment of a new shelter by Women's Community Shelters. But Annabelle says more needs to be done by governments.
When we think about infrastructure, we can't just think in terms of roads and schools and shopping centres and parks. We have to acknowledge that there will be social issues that come with any increasing population, and we absolutely need to plan for them.
Professor Wendt made clear her thoughts on what is an overwhelming crisis.
Continue to have conversations, you know, as a community and as a society about this issue, no matter how hard it is to face. Otherwise, we're not going to come up with a solution.
Professor Sarah Wendt ending that report by Julia Andre.
Cancel those dinner plans, call off the wedding and free up your September because the Sydney Fringe Festival starts in under 2 weeks. Get amongst the decade of fringe experience on Sunday, September 1st as King Street Crawl and Fringe Ignite join forces for the biggest opening party yet. This year, Fringe Ignite takes hold of South King Street, Newtown with a swagger of great music in all your favourite haunts. Check out all the details for Fringe Ignite and the rest of this year's unmissable lineup now at sydneyfringe.com. 2SER is a media partner of Sydney Fringe.
Saturday, August 31st is UTS Open Day. See our tech-driven learning spaces, imagine yourself with our community of innovators, and experience our hands-on approach to learning. UTS Open Day, Saturday, August 31st. Register now at openday.uts.edu.au. 2SER sponsors.
I'm Daniel Butler, and you are listening to Razor's Edge, coming to you live from this place known as Sydney, on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, of which sovereignty was never ceded. Well, the continuing protests in Kong have been playing out here at home as well. Several clashes across the country, including right here in Sydney, between Chinese and Hong Kong foreign students, have highlighted the tensions between the two powers. I spoke to Dr. Christine Cunningham from Edith Cowan University on whether we can see more of these clashes and the cultural reasons at their heart. Why is it that we've seen these clashes here in Sydney and elsewhere between Chinese mainland students and those from Hong Kong?
Well, of course, no one knows for sure, so that would be the first part I'd say. But my PhD student, Wei Jiang, she's been investigating why mainland Chinese students come to Australia, and we didn't investigate why the Hong Kong students come to Australia to study, because they're quite open and frank about it, and they live in a society that lets you talk about the motivations. And we just wanted to know a lot more about why the mainland Chinese people were coming too. And what Wei's study's finding is that they have, a very different education system, and it means that the Hong Kong and the mainland Chinese students, when they're here, perhaps for the first time, are confronting those differences in how they've been taught to think about democracy and freedom and safety and the rule of law and so many different topics. It's a wonderful PhD that she's doing. We're so proud of her.
I suppose there's a lesson in there in the clashes between the Chinese and Hong Kong students and the relationship of those students to Australia and their learning in a similarly different educational environment in terms of liberal ideals and all of that.
That's right. So, you know, I work in a university like everybody else who's working in universities. We have so many international students, which is such a privilege, and they come and, you know, we're teaching them lots of things, but whether we're also teaching them enough about who we are as Australians and what's important to us as a people. And so, for example, I'm a deputy mayor of a local government area, and, you know, we do the citizenship ceremonies every month, and we pledge to be loyal to our country and to love the ideals of rule of law, freedom of assembly, freedom of opinion, the media being open and widely diverse. And we hope that what we're doing is showing and role modelling that to our students. But unfortunately, Waze data is suggesting that that's not getting through at all, and that a lot of Australians who are at the universities are just ignoring the international students, and there's sort of a real barrier between the two groups, and maybe that's just not the way for growing empathy and understanding and keeping us all in a really peaceful situation, which is what we want.
Certainly. I wonder, though, some of those ideals that you cited, that you say at the citizenship ceremonies, is there any particular evidence that the Chinese students who come here to study show an interest in those ideals?
Well, I don't think a lot of the students are coming to study the humanities and the social sciences and doing a Bachelor of Arts in politics and sociology. And I imagine that those types of students around the world would be interested in that. But perhaps if you're coming to do hard sciences and things like that, it's not on your radar. And I don't know that we're ever offering enough opportunities yet. We don't have that data. We just know that the people that we interviewed haven't tried to access it and didn't find it easy to access those sorts of things. For example, most of them have never been to the footy. You know, I don't go to the football either. I don't like AFL. But, you know, that's such an Australian thing to do, and it gets you to know a lot about Australia. And not one of them had been. And, you know, what are we doing?
Certainly. Is there any evidence that information or disinformation, as it may be, being propagated on the internet has been a factor in the protests here in Australia, the information around the Hong Kong?
Look, I don't think that Waze study investigated that, but what we do know, we did ask about the mainland Chinese students' use of social media, and this is in my experience as well, as you know, I go up and I teach in China too, is that we're starting to create two internets, or maybe we've already created two internet systems. But, you know, I'm on Facebook and I'm on Twitter, those sorts of applications. Other people are on Weibo and WeChat, and we're not really communicating with each other, and we're in these silos. You know, I now am on WeChat as well, and I can press the translate button like Chinese people can do on Twitter, but we just aren't. So everybody's getting very different messages. On my Twitter feed, I'm trying to watch all of the Hong Kong protesters, but at the same time, I'm also trying to watch all of the people who completely disagree with them. And I'd just like to, I love that I have the freedom to see what China's telling us about what's going on there, and I'm also able to see what Taiwan's telling us and what Hong Kong people are telling us, and I really appreciate that.
Certainly. Well, is it troubling for the universities that we've seen these clashes? I mean, some of them have been violent to a degree.
I certainly can't speak for my university or any others, but of course, anything that's not peaceful is completely counterproductive to the whole reason that we have a tertiary system in Australia. And, you know, universities are about the public good, I believe, not about how much money we can make and what a fantastic sector we are for the bottom line of a government, but we're here to teach at a deep level of critical thinking and making each other understand each other better. And that's what WAVE study is about. It's about who are we and why do we travel to other countries and what are we hoping to learn from each other?
Dr. Christine Cunningham from Edith Cowan University ending that report. Well, that's all we have time for tonight. Thanks for listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. Razor's Edge is produced on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. Catch us again next week on Thursday night at 7:30. I'm Daniel Butler. Till next time.